Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So you just have to love late lunch listeners, wouldn't you, Louise?
Well, they love you, Romeo. Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
What are we talking about?
Don't mind me, I'm just jealous.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of green eye in there, all right,
there's
folks.
There's a big bit of it.
Because yesterday, as you know, on the show, we were talking to Tara Gartland about her wonderful Easter eggs, and then the conversation developed into, why are there no mugs with Easter eggs much this year? Then you deluged us with your pictures of Easter egg mugs, and ultimately, Louise told us, what did you say? You love Lear, and what other Easter egg?
Whisper.
Was it Whisper? And I didn't mention Malteser, but then when Louise said, oh, there is a catch Easter egg, I said, oh my God, that would be my favourite. And then you explained to me as well, there was a fruit nut Easter egg, you know, with the fruit nut built into the egg itself.
Yep.
Well, folks, shortly after the show yesterday, Mary arrived in with a catch Easter egg for me.
That was so sweet.
So sweet. Mary, thanks a million. And just a wee while ago, Lorraine arrived with a dairy milk fruit nut egg for me.
So I was right, there were two women.
Yes. Lorraine, I love you. Honest to God.
I have
almighty.
His phone number. I'll give it to you later.
I'm delighted. I'm chuffed. I'm absolutely chuffed. I really am. And having had no chalky walky do that for the length and season.
Does that not annoy you now? Will you know, would you just yearn to open it?
No.
No.
Good
no, man.
No, no,
fair
no,
no.
No, I'll go to Sunday. You know, I'll go the whole hog right till Sunday and then I will. I certainly will enjoy a little bit of chocolate and my cheese.
You can
and
have
onion.
It for breakfast.
Yeah. Dinner and tea.
Yeah.
The whole lot.
Christmas Day and Easter Sunday. Only time you get away with eating chocolate.
You would, all day. It's
all
as
day.
Simple as that. Ladies, thank you. Thank you for your kindness. Thank you for your thoughtfulness. I really, really
so
do.
So you're only short of a Malteser one.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Hey. Don't be now. I'm getting embarrassed. Look at my cheeks starting to go red here. That Louise one now is fishing for sure. Anyway, we want to give you something on Late Lunch today, tomorrow and Thursday, because you know we're coming live from the Valley in Malera this Thursday with the show. Drop out and say hello. We'd love to see you. Anyway, they're celebrating 10 years in business there, and John, Jackie and the crew would be delighted to welcome you for delicious bar food, lunch, early board or a la carte, 7 days a week. Great food, excellent customer service with a smile. The Valley Inn is the place to check out. I have a €100 voucher from the Valley Inn to give away to one of you today. You know the story at this stage. I've checked out their a la carte menu and the main courses. I'm going to give you 3 main courses from a menu, but there's one of them on the Valley Inn menu. The other two aren't. You have to get the one that's on the Valley Inn main course a la carte menu. And when we ring you, if you enter the competition, send us in a message. This is how you enter. WhatsApp or text Valley Inn. WhatsApp or text Valley Inn now with your name and details to 086 1800 658. That's 086 1800 658. Stand by your phone for the rest of the afternoon. If you don't answer, you're not getting the prize. If you answer, get the correct answer, you win the prize. If you get the wrong answer, we're going to ring somebody else. So get cracking now. €100 from the Valley Inn on Late Lunch today. 086 1800 658 by WhatsApp or text. And we'll call one of you and give you that lovely prize before the end of the show. Now, I'm just back from Sea Point Golf Club. I am, because it was a big morning out there. The Irish Legends Golf is returning to Sea Point in June. And there was a very famous Irish golfer there earlier today. I'm not going to say any more. Here it is. Have a listen.
Legends Tour back in Sea Point Golf Club for 2024, and big announcement today at the launch in the club itself, because one of our most famous golfers has just been announced as an ambassador for the Legends for 2024. Paul McGinley, how does that make you feel?
Thank you, Gerry. Yeah, I didn't play golf last year. We had a lot of family issues going on that kind of and health issues that stopped me from playing. So I'm looking forward to getting back on a horse in 2024 and playing a bit of golf. Yeah.
The Legends Tour, you've been talking about it this morning there, where it fits in with the main tour and the Challenge Tour as well. For our listeners today, just explain why Legends is so important.
Well, Legends is anybody age 50 years and over, and a lot of names that everybody be synonymous around. Bernard Langer, Ian Woosnam, Nick Faldo, you know, Seve Ballester, if he was around now, would all be part of that 50 plus tour. We play, you know, nice tournaments in a pro-am format all the way around the world. And, you know, amateurs come and play, and we go to really nice venues like Sea Point here. And Barbados is where the first event is going to be. And, you know, the idea is that we go to elite venues and, you know, that amateurs come along and play in a pro-am format and enjoy the company of, well, legends of the game.
It worked brilliantly last year. I have to say, I was here. We had a special show from the venue while it was on. And what struck me was the relaxed atmosphere, the fun, the camaraderie between the pros and the celebs and the people coming to watch the golf as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's exactly what it is, and that's what I enjoy more than anything. Obviously, the prize monies are, you know, moderate compared to what's on the main tours now, very moderate. You're not playing to make a whole lot of money on it, but you are playing it because it's in your genes to be a competitor and to be a golfer, and it's in your genes because these guys are friends. You know, you played with them on the main tour for, you know, 25 years. They've all become personal friends, and it's like going back and meeting your old schoolmates again when you play a tournament on the Legends, and there's an immediate bond. Because the great thing about golf is, you know, when you are out playing and competing, even at the very highest level in the game, the ultimate competitor is the golf course. It's not, you know, so you don't really get the antagonism you might have in other sports where one competitor is playing against another. You're actually, you know, all of us are united in terms of playing against the golf course. So as a result, a lot of strong bonds and friendships are formed, and you know, they carry through right into your older years.
You mentioned you were a member next door in Baltrae for years, and Sea Point was being constructed at that stage. It's a relatively young links course, but what a track. It's made a big step forward as well since Carr got involved here.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, it's an excellent golf course, really well designed. And, you know, you've got one of Ireland's great golf courses next door in Baltrae, one of my favourite golf courses, if not my favourite golf course to play anywhere in Ireland. And I think that, you know, there's a great opportunity to sell links golf courses in Ireland, because we're seeing, you know, Americans come in their millions, you know, hundreds of thousands every year coming in, paying huge green fees, spending a lot of money in the local economy. That money goes into the Irish Exchequer. They come in and they want to play links golf courses. And what's happened, the southwest of Ireland was where it all started. And that has really ignited to the point that it's sold out this year and next year if you want to play a game of golf on any of the well-known courses down there. So now people are looking for alternative places to go. And obviously the East Coast is perfect. You come right out of Dublin Airport, you just go a little bit north and you've got Baltrae, and then you've got here, and then you've got County Down, and then you've got Arglass, and you've got Dundalk, and you've got Warren Point. And, you know, one after the other, you've got all of these brilliant golf courses one after the other, and the Americans are hunting out for links golf courses in particular.
Yeah, links in demand for sure. When you look out as we sit in this beautiful room here and the finishing hole, it's just beyond where we sit today. There's some fantastic holes on the Sea Point course.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, the natural dunes that are there and the marum grass, you know, blowing in the wind. And, you know, Americans love all that stuff because, you know, they don't have it in America. Links golf courses are only, you can only get them in Britain and Ireland. They are not, even though there's some similar styles, it's not the true essence of links golf courses anywhere in the world except Britain and Ireland. So that's what makes them so unique. That'll always be the case. And, you know, any golf courses that are built along the coast in Ireland for future generations, for, you know, years and years and years and decades to come, that's going to be a huge generator and importance to the Irish economy. And it's why the government spends so much money in, you know, Tourism Ireland and also Fáilte Ireland to, you know, promote Ireland as a golfing destination, because it has huge benefits for the economy.
You mentioned that over the age of 50, people joined the Legends Tour. But that competitive streak, you talked about it earlier on as well, that burns brightly in the pros. And I have to say, there are some very handy amateur celebs who play along as well.
Yeah, there is. And that's what's nice about it. They combine a lot of celebrity stardust as well in the pro-am formats. And you get to meet a lot of those guys. Some of them are ex-soccer players. You know, some of them could be singers. They come from all kinds of show business, if you want to call it that way, are actors, all kinds. And, you know, you become friends with them as well, too. And that's what the real benefit of, you know, people who pay a good fee to come and play and be a part of a Legends event, wherever it may be in the world, is not only do you go to a great destination, but you socialise and spend time together. And, you know, it's a combination of amateurs who just love to play and got a few quid and can invest in themselves to go and have a fun event. And they get to meet celebrities and they get to meet players who, you know, household names in terms of the world of golf. So everybody's combined, socialising at night, having dinner together and in a relaxed atmosphere. You know, it's not the cut and throat competitive arena that you would have on the main tour, but there's always a competitive edge. And the standard is very, very good. A lot of the guys can play still very, very well to a good standard.
You're wearing your Sky Sports Gansey here this morning, and I love listening to you guys. I follow it intensely through the year. The Masters is on the horizon. I couldn't not ask you today, who's going to win the Masters this year? Who do you fancy?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to say that you fancy Scottie Scheffler at the moment. This guy, you know, his statistics are off the scale. We haven't seen golf played to a consistent level and as high a standard as he's played since Tiger Woods at his very height. And not even just the standard Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods at his very best. This guy is matching that standard. So what I like about him is he quietly goes about his business in a very, very competitive manner. His course management is off the scale compared to everybody else in the game. That's where he gets an edge. And, he's won a couple of weeks ago. He won back-to-back events. He's in good form going in here. And, he's a guy who's going to win, you know, many, many major championships if he remains healthy, because it looks like he's the full package.
The culmination of the Players' Championship was one of the best finishes in years. God, it was unmissable, I have to say. But you have guys there like Wyndham Clark, you know, who's in form this year. What about our Irish lads? What about Rory? Is he going to do it at last?
Yeah, Rory's come off the boil a little bit this year. He had a good start out in Dubai, but he hasn't really played very well in America the last month by his high standards. So he's off the boil. Sometimes that's not a bad thing, because if anybody in the game can turn it around quickly, he's the one that you would say. He can go from really playing poorly, having a bad run, to winning straight away. Not many can ignite the way that Rory can. So I wouldn't be too down on him, and I think he's certainly a player that, going under the radar a little bit, not playing as well going into the Masters this year like he was last year. He was playing great going into the Masters last year. He was the bookies' favourite. Everybody fancied him. He fancied himself. He was playing so well in practice that everybody thought that this was going to be the year, and then he went and he missed a cut. So expectation is a very heavy burden to carry, and this year he's not going in with the same expectation. His form is not quite the same, so he's a little bit under the radar. Everybody's talking about Scottie Scheffler, and that could be an environment for him to thrive. So fingers crossed, because I think the game, and I think he would really benefit should he win the Masters and complete the Grand Slam. And he'd be the first player since Tiger Woods to do that, and only the sixth player in the history of the game to win all four major championships. And I think his career deserves it. I really would like to see him complete that Grand Slam. And I think it would be good for the game to have a standout player of the modern era.
We follow the tour, follow you, listen to you and hang on every word. Where is LIV Golf? Is anybody watching LIV Golf? I have to ask this question. And how do we reconcile the LIV players coming into the Masters? You don't hear much about them.
No, they're off on a different tangent. That's a tangent paved in gold, obviously, with the money that they're all being paid to do that. They're travelling around the world. It doesn't have any mainstream coverage on TV. You can get it on YouTube if you want to watch it. But from what I understand, you know, the viewing figures are very small. And even though the players are, you know, making a fortune playing it, obviously the players who have remained on the tours feel that they've kind of divided the game by leaving and going to the LIV Tour. So there's a divide going on. There's talk about a peace settlement and talk about some kind of a deal and a common ground. But from what I understand, that's probably going to be at least 2 years away, at least if they are going to find a common ground in that. But having said that, a lot of the LIV players are going to be eligible to play in the major championships. So the majors will be the four platforms this year where you'll see the both tours combined.
Well, to finish today, we are in Seapoint Golf Links in County Louth. The Irish Legends are here between the 19th and the 22nd of June. You are the brand new ambassador for the Legends Tour, Paul McGinley. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Lunch on LMFM Radio today. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
Thank you. Nice to be back in the East Coast and seeing the lovely links of Seapoint and Baltrae, where I've got so many fond memories. I spent about 10 years there as a junior and spent a lot of time in the area and getting to know everybody. So great to be back among them again.
Paul McGinley, a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're heading to Dundurry now, and I'm joined by a very good friend of the show. He's famously known as a matchmaker of people, but he certainly matched a ram and a yo when it comes to sheep, because a one in a million story he has. Gus Martin, welcome back to Late Lunch.
Well, Jerry, good afternoon. Are you well?
I'm really well. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. You have it. You certainly have it. The matchmaking gift, be it humans or animals. Tell us the story of Beans, who gave birth to what?
Well, she had five lambs there Monday morning at 6 o'clock. So great to have five lambs. As you said, it's one in a million. And she had the first one on her own. And the second one was breech or back ways, so she needed assistance, and I helped her along them myself and my wife Olive, and we took out number 2, number 3, number 4, and number 5.
Gus, when they're coming out like that, do you think they'll never stop? It's normally one or two, isn't it?
I kept searching for another one, but I, in fairness, five is, as you said, one in a million, and it's great. You know, it'd be great to have them.
Oh, yeah. So there's 3 yos and 2 ram lambs in the 5 of them. What weight were they roughly each? Were they all around the same weight, would you say, Gus?
Really, between 1.75 kilos up to 2.25 kilos.
Right, so decent.
So, decent lamb, decent weight, and all going very, very well. Of course, once they arrive on the ground, indoors, of course, that's when the work starts from yourself and out of, because it's bottles and, you know, they have to get colostrums fairly quick. These things might be known as that. And they get 100 cc's each first. And if you don't get that colostrum, don't get that beastings, they won't survive.
Yes.
And, you know, we're lucky that they were inside, because the weather conditions is very bad, you know. So,
yeah.
They wouldn't survive outside.
No, I needn't. They wouldn't have survived, but you and Olive were there to help with the breech birth, and then the others arrived. You're two wonderful midwives. They couldn't have better care, I have to say, than the pair of you. And they're thriving, Gus, I believe.
Aye, they're going very well now, in fairness. Up last, of course, 12 o'clock, 12 and 3, at 3 o'clock again, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock. I mean, if you don't look at them, they will die. I must say, like, farmers are very busy around springtime. There's calves born, cows, sheep born, lambs born, or, you know, foals born. They're very, very busy people, and sometimes they don't get enough credit for it.
Yes. And I totally agree with you there. It's a life of commitment and love to what you all do, and I admire you from afar, I have to say. Now, tell us about the mammy here. There's history in this mother sheep's family. Was it her mother or granny had 5 as well?
Well, her mammy had 4.
4, okay.
But the biggest thing about the mammy was the time dogs attacked sheep. Of course, I'd be always asking and telling people to lock the dogs up at night. I had nearly 30 sheep killed in me back in 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
And the granny of this, the mother of this sheep was actually sick, and her ear was bitten off, and she was sick for about a fortnight. So really, I was given this ration of meal, which there was beef pulp in it, there was beans in it, there was citrus in it, the whole lot. But all she'd eat was the beans. And that's why her name was called Beans.
I love it. I love it. And the ram is called Tinder. So the mother is Beans of these. Beans is the name of the mam of these five. The dad is yes. Tinder, and he's a ram who serviced your 40 sheep there. And why did you call him Tinder?
Well, I'll tell you the story about him now. Is that we're kind of busy one day anyway, and I had no ram last August. So I rang the Mart manager, owner, James Mallon of Calvin Ross Mart, and I said, there's a few nice rams down there. He says, there's plenty. I said, I haven't time to go down. So I said, would you pick me out a number there of a decent ram? So he did. So I bought him online as such. So then I called him Tinder after that, because I used to be matchmaking, and when the COVID hit, everyone went to Tinder instead of going through a matchmaker.
Yes.
Well, thanks to God, that's back now again anyways. But thanks to James Mallon, he picked a decent ram for me, in fairness.
He certainly did. He's not one that's firing blanks, for sure. That's a truism. And listen, Gus, it's great. I know you're busy there, and you're in the middle of the yard there, and you're working away there. Thanks for taking the call. Good luck to you and Olive and the five new arrivals.
Jerry, thanks very much. Bye. Good luck.
God bless you. Bye. That's Gus Martin there. One in a million. You're with Late Lunch on LMFM Radio this Tuesday afternoon. I'm going to talk about a book for the next while on the show. It's called The Cancer Guide, How to Nurture Wellbeing Through and Beyond a Cancer Diagnosis. It's by Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer. And when I tell you that Anne-Marie is Clinical Professor at Trinity College Dublin and a psychiatrist with almost four decades clinical experience, she's worked for years in this area with patients and their families. And this is her first book, even though she had a previous one that she did with the Oxford University Press. But this book is for you, me and everybody else listening today. And I'm delighted to say she's sitting in the hot seat in studio. Welcome to the show, Anne-Marie.
Thank you very much.
Can I say to you that I devoured this book in one evening from cover to cover, and having had experience of cancer in my family, you have done a wonderful job with this book. I want to say that from the outset. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
When you hear the word cancer and you get a diagnosis, let's start from that point, and you take us through the various stages when, you know, you may suspect you get a diagnosis.
Sure.
Then you go on into the treatment stage and beyond. The fear in the word is still there.
Yes, and please interrupt me, because I could talk forever about this, so feel free to interrupt. But absolutely, and that is the point of the book. I do think it's important to say at the start that, of course, treatment for cancer has improved so much. And it's important for people listening to they know that, I know, but just to repeat that, you know, we're picking it up earlier, the treatments are better, people are surviving, but, and that's the big but, there's still huge fear attached to the word cancer. Some people don't want even to use the word. And that is the point of the book, is that it's the human impact, it's the psychological response. It's what cancer means to the person that really carries the impact of a cancer diagnosis, on the diagnosis, on the treatment, and most importantly, on how they reclaim their lives afterwards.
When you get the diagnosis, I suppose to start from there, telling people, you know what I mean? Telling your family, if you have children. Look at the princess at the moment, high profile, Kate Middleton. Mm-hmm. What's happened, you know, and she has three young children as well. Mm-hmm. You know, letting people know that point to start from.
Yes. So in fact, I would say it's before the diagnosis, because a lot of people suspect, they worry, they're panic stricken. I talk about that before the diagnosis. They're lying awake at night time.
Yes.
They have terrible images in their minds often of dying, or you know, their family bereft. They're very, very frightening, terrible images. And then often when somebody actually says to them, yes, it is cancer, people say to me, it's like being hit by a bus. I feel all the air has been sucked out of the room. I can't breathe. I can't believe that other people are still talking, because my life has changed irrevocably at that moment. I feel everything is different. People say things like, my whole life has been thrown up into the air and I'm waiting to see where the pieces land. People's lives stop. It's like people like yourself and myself who are, you know, making plans, and then suddenly cancer hits and it's like everything stops. And that's not only the feeling of shock, there's lots of other emotions as well. You've probably seen, you know, fear is probably the biggest one. But there's lots of others. There's a huge sense of grief, sense of loss, all the things that people, loss of certainty. We all think we've got certainty. We make plans for tomorrow and next week. We actually don't have certainty, but we think we do. The person with cancer, they've lost that sense of certainty. They've a loss also of their role, you know, the sense that they can't do what they did before, and how humiliated sometimes they feel about that. That loss of independence. They need help with many things. You know, they've got to go to the hospital for their treatment. They've got to get transport. They can't sometimes do the most basic of things. So they lose so many things. And of course, as a result, sometimes they have a huge sense of anger. How has this happened to me? I was a good person. I ate well. I exercised. I did everything right. And here I am. It's not fair. A sense of the world is not fair.
And come back to that point of, you know, when you know, and telling children, telling your family.
You did ask me that.
And then how do I, as I know, say you have a diagnosis, how do I broach it with you? So from those two perspectives.
Okay, so telling people, absolutely. So telling people close to you, I think when anybody has a shock, they need time to accustom themselves to it first. So I think sometimes people need a bit of time to get their own head around what's happened to them. And often if they can share it with somebody they're very close to, maybe a partner or whoever that happens to be. So they need time to gather themselves first. And once they've gathered themselves, then they can choose who they want to tell and how they want to tell.
Okay.
But often it's about just gathering yourself first, because you don't want to sit down and blab out things before you've had a chance to decide yourself what you want to say and who you want to tell. That's the first thing.
Okay, and then if I know somebody close to me, a friend or whatever, has cancer, how do you broach that with them?
Yes, there's several chapters on that, because it's, you know, if you've got somebody, because cancer, of course, never just affects one person, which is what you're trying to get me to say. And you're right. You know, there's a person with cancer in the middle, but there's all the people around them, close loved ones, family and friends. They all want the person to do well, but they're struggling to know what to say. So what I think is the less said, the better, because, you know, often people are anxious and they don't know what to say. And that's a bad position to be in, because often you then blurt out something that you didn't mean to say. And I've lots of examples of that where people would come into me with cancer and say, "You won't believe what Johnny said to me yesterday." But I still think it's important to acknowledge it. So I think acknowledge it and then listen to what the person says back to you. If you say, "Look, I heard you had some difficult news recently.
Yes.
I'm so sorry to hear that." If they say, "You're right, I love your shirt, it really cheers me up," then they don't want to talk about it anymore, and that's their right, and you follow that lead. If they say to you, "Yes, it's absolutely terrible. To be honest with you, I'm reeling," then you give them the opportunity. So please listen to the person with cancer. They will give you the guide if you listen.
So you have the diagnosis and then a plan is formed. And you talk in the book then about the importance of the team who look after you, because you are then in the system, you're taken in and you're managed by a varying team of people. And I want to read something, because, of course, your specialist, cancer specialist, your surgeon or whatever, is a big person in your journey, along with the oncology units. We have one brilliant one here in the hospital in Drogheda who mind people, and they're just loved there.
Yes.
But I want to read from page 45 of the book, because this is so important to people listening today. And it's a quote from Alan Bennett. Yes, the famous Alan Bennett, who was going through his own cancer journey, a playwright and novelist, very famous. And he encountered a hospital receptionist one day. I just want to read this little line. And this is to quote Alan Bennett. He said to the lady, or it may have been a gentleman receptionist, "Listen, you are as essential to the work of this hospital as its most exalted consultant. You can do more for the spirits of patients coming to this institution than the most skillful surgeon just by being nice." Now, that struck me in the book as very, very significant, because there are lots of people involved in this care.
Well, it's funny. I read that, obviously, in a book by Alan Bennett, and it really struck a chord with me as well. I think for all of us working in healthcare, it's important to remember, exactly as you said, that for the person that we're seeing, it's a very important meeting for them. Often they'll have travelled a long way. They'll be very afraid. And what we say and how we say it and how we interact is hugely important. And everybody has a part to play in
yes.
that. And I saw that myself. I work in James's, is the hospital that I've been working in Dublin. But every single person, often somebody would say to me, a patient would say to me, it's the lady bringing in the teas every day that cheers me up. How she says hello, you know, what she says, what will you have? Or they have a joke about something. Every single person has a role to play. I think that's so important.
It really is important to emphasise that. Come back to the diagnosis and you're going into the treatment and all that and your thoughts. You know, your thoughts run right through this book, you know, completely. And mm-hmm. There is lots of information out there. Dr. Google.
Yes, I mean...
you mentioned Dr. Google.
I do, absolutely. So what I say in the book is information is power. Information empowers people. Patients used to say to me, if only I had known, and that was the spirit the book was written in, if only I had known that everybody else was struggling, that everybody else finds it difficult, but most importantly, if only I had known what to expect from a psychological point of view. So, for example, the fact that actually the end of treatment is often the most difficult time. And I'm going to go back to what you asked me now before I head down that path. But Dr. Google, yes, you see, look, we can all search for information so easy now. Google, 2 minutes.
Yes.
But it's the quality of the information and it's whether or not the information is relevant to you and important to you. And also, is the information helpful?
And I think that is such an important point to make because it's the Wild West out there. And, you know, talk about your psychological aspect of this, you know, being so important. If you listened or read or took on board everything that's out there, you'd be all over the place. Here's the other thing I just want to mention. We always hear about positivity. And,
yes.
and this is a word that comes in all the time.
Yes.
You've got to be positive. You've got to be positive.
Yeah.
You say in this book, no.
Well, what I say is, if you find me somebody that's positive all the time, do bring me along to meet them because there's clearly a problem. It's not possible to be positive all the time. Life gets in the way. And it's particularly not possible to be positive all the time if you're struggling with cancer. And the big problem is if people think they have, and this I say this, somebody with cancer who hears, there's so many myths about cancer. This is the top myth that most distresses me. Because what happens is the person with cancer is sitting there saying, oh, apparently you have to be positive all the time. I'm not. I'm upset. I'm angry. I'm distressed. I'm afraid. And not only do they think that then they're not, to use that other word that I have an issue with, battling cancer properly, if their cancer, they don't do well, they somehow think it's their fault. It's a terrible threat to live under. Mm. And in fact, a friend of mine who got the book, who I know is having a very difficult time with cancer, texted me having read that line and said, thank you so much for saying that. Because what they said was, you know, it's hard enough getting up in the morning and getting out to get my chemotherapy without thinking I have to be. It's just not possible.
No, it's not. I'm delighted you made that point. Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer is with me on Late Lunch. She's written the most brilliant book called The Cancer Guide. And we're talking about it on Late Lunch this afternoon. Can I ask you about that point you brought up a few moments ago about when the treatment ends and it's over and the team that we mentioned that looked after you so well say, off you go now. You know, that point.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing me back to that. Because if you were to say to me one point, you're only allowed to make one point, this would be it. And when I say, if only I had known, that's what people talk about. So what happens is, totally understandably, and it's a wonderful idea, everybody pins their hopes on the end of treatment. Of course they do. They ring it in the calendar, their family, their friends say, it's going to be fantastic, you'll be finished, we'll have a celebration. And the person with cancer, of course, you know, pins their hopes in that. And then they get to the day that's the end of their treatment and they are absolutely wrecked. First of all, they're physically wrecked because they've been through radiation, surgery, chemo, whatever. So they can barely move. So they're physically exhausted. And often they've kind of kept themselves going by saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then they get to the end and they suddenly collapse and they think, what has happened to me? This has been terrible. I have faced death. I've just about survived. What am I going to do now? And then they're hugely disappointed because in their head, they'll have had these images of celebrations jumping around the place. And it's not like that. It's just literally they have crawled over the line. And then so many other things have happened. So the hospital, which, to be honest, many people find very difficult to go into every week, now they realise that actually they've missed that, how are you doing, how are you getting on, and they've lost that reassurance. I have a pain and ache, the nurses say, you're grand, you'll be fine. So they've lost that reassurance, and then their friends and family are saying to them, God, you must be delighted. Isn't it great? You finished your treatment. And they're thinking, no, it's not great. I'm absolutely wrecked. And then they feel guilty that they're not more grateful to their family and friends and to their treating team, etc. So the message is, yes, the end of treatment is wonderful. It's the start of rehabilitation. And you need to say to everybody, friends, family, I am going to need you so much now. I'm not going to be strong enough to say thank you. Not yet. So hang on in there. Still give me that support. I'll need it for at least 6 months, maybe longer. And if it's less than 6 months, great. But let me know if it's less than 6 months. So absolutely, it's the start of rehabilitation. It's as important as the treatment.
Because you are, perhaps if you're working in time, you hope to get back to work, yes, which is a huge issue. You mightn't have been socially active at all. Going out again, meeting people.
Thank you so much for you that. Know. You know, because again, I talk about that. It's very difficult. Let's take going out to meet people after you've had cancer. Some people feel so vulnerable. They feel that everybody knows they've got cancer. They've got people, again, coming back to what we talked about, meaning well, saying, oh, it's lovely to see you. You poor thing. You've been through. They might not want to talk about that or share that. Or we've people who say really terrible things like, you know, oh, you got the all clear. Oh, my sister got the all clear. She was dead a month later. Or something. You're thinking, why would somebody say that? But they say it because they're nervous and they think, oh, I better say something.
It's not malice.
I really think people mean well. So it can be very difficult. And part of going through that with people who've had cancer is almost rehearsing how to take charge. They haven't been able to take charge for months. Everybody else has been doing it for them. So how to manage the conversation. We touched on it earlier. They might say, oh, I love your shirt. That is a message. I don't want to talk about cancer.
Yeah.
Or the rugby result or something, yes, or the local GA.
You've got to take your lead from the person themselves. Here's the other thing about it. The person who's been through the diagnosis, the care and treatment, it's finished. Psychologically, let's come back to this again because this is a huge part of this book, the psychology of all this.
It's all about that.
It's all about this.
Yes.
Will it come back?
So that is a very important and very difficult area. And I think anybody who's been through cancer, as I said to you, that sense of certainty, you and me saying what we'll do next week or next year, they lose that. Now, some people, as time goes on and their cancer becomes more in the distance, they sort of begin to get that certainty back again. And that's great. But there are people who have to really work hard on that fear. What if it comes back? How will I manage it? And trying to bring them into the present. How are you now? How are you? This is once they've been through their rehabilitation. Are you well? How can we focus you on using how you are at the moment? Is it helpful to think about what if it comes back? Not really. It's using up their time. Now, it's easy for me to say that, and there'll be people listening louder than me saying, that's all very well for Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer sitting there in a chair saying that. I hear you. I know it is not easy. Believe you me, I have heard it from so many people. But it's finding a way to help people move that torchlight from what might be about to happen to what is happening at the moment. And that is important, not just for everybody with cancer, but for all of us. Where are we now? What are we doing now?
As I went through the book and you break it down brilliantly into the various parts, and then I come towards the end. And I have to ask you, the final section of this book, section 6, is cancer and dying. Was that difficult?
Yes. I did not want to write that chapter.
I thought that.
No, I didn't want to write that chapter because nobody working in healthcare wants to look at this. You know, we all want our patients to be well and to do well. But unfortunately, the truth is not everybody does well. And we have to talk about it. We have to acknowledge it. Because if we are too upset or distressed or fearful to talk about it, where does leave the person who is facing that?
Yes.
So I had to write that chapter. I have written that chapter about dying. It is a very, very difficult area. I hope that most of the people listening to us today are not facing that. But for those people that are, we have to address it. We have to talk about it. We have to give them the option to discuss it. And you'll see that I say in the book, even people who know that that's what they're facing, they often don't want to give up hope. I have had people literally sitting opposite me, and they know and I know that that's what's down the road, but they do not want their hope to be taken away. So we have to, again, follow their lead. I gave an example of somebody who said, I'm tired. Mm. I want to go home. I need a break. Now, in fact, they knew that actually what they were saying is, I want to go home to die. They did not say that to me. Yes. They said, I'm tired. I want to go home. I need a break.
Yes.
That's fine. That's the way they want to do it. That's, again, follow their lead.
I have to say, in the book, besides your brilliant words, the case studies are fantastic. And the case studies underpin, you they understand.
Do. They do. No, the case studies are the patient's voices.
Yes.
And those are very powerful voices. Nobody can do better than a story of a person who's been through this. So very deliberately, the book is based around stories, real life stories of people that I looked after, but obviously changed, anonymized details. So that people pick up the book and say, that's my story. Well, it is, but everything has been changed because I did not want to give personal details, obviously, of people that I looked after.
And it's important to say that cancer treatment has advanced so much. People say 20, 30 years ago who got a diagnosis are living with this today.
Yes.
And living good lives and
absolutely
long lives. And every day you hear of more and more advances in this field.
Yes.
Which is great news.
It is. And that's why I said that at the beginning. It's very important to say that, yes, there is so much good news about cancer now. And so many treatments. I have looked after patients. I've one person in mind at the moment. When she first came to see me, she said, apparently I have 2 years. She lived for 8. And she used that time. She used that time. She was able to get her head around it. So it's very important to say to people, yes, there are lots of great treatments all the time. This lady, literally each year, something new would come along and keep her going. It was wonderful. But I suppose the thing is to help people live those lives to the best of their ability. And that the human impact or the psychological impact is not what is holding them back. That's what this is about.
Just before we finish, I want to come back to that point about the positivity and that it's impossible to be positive of all the time. It's great to have a positive outlook, of course, but there will be days when that won't happen. And you say, to quote you again, set aside some time to worry each day. That's okay.
Absolutely. So we're having this conversation in between the mics coming on. You know, it's not possible to be, I mean, show me somebody who's positive all the time. There's something seriously wrong. Certainly not positive, possible to be positive all the time with cancer. But if you have worries, rather than letting them eat up all of your time, say, okay, I'm going to worry about those not too late into the evening or you won't sleep. Maybe at 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock. That'll be my worry time. I'll sit down for half an hour and I'll worry for Ireland for that half an hour. And then I'll pick up again, because otherwise it interferes with all of your day.
Yes. Yeah, it's very, very important. Look, I could go on and on. It's simply wonderful. It's called The Cancer Guide by Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer. It's available all over the place at the moment. It's brilliant. You've done a wonderful, wonderful job. You really have. Put it in laywoman and layman's language. Well done to you. Thank you for joining me on Late Lunch today.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Now it's Easter week. It is indeed on Late Lunch. Mary-Anne Dalton is on the line. She's a chemistry lecturer and she can rustle up a thing or two in the kitchen as well. We've spoken to her before. Mary-Anne, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, I'll tell you why you're with me today. I'm going to kill that Louise one. I'm just looking at the running order here. She did that on purpose on me. We're going to talk about a simnel cake. S-I-M-N-E-L. And guess what Louise put on the running order, because she's been slagging me about this. She said there's no such thing. She put on the running order a semolina cake in the name of Saint Christopher.
Well,
no,
you know, she's actually, I'm going to give you a little bit of the history, and she's not far wrong, because actually the reason semolina and simnel come from exactly the same Latin root. And so there's a twist. She's not that far wrong.
1-0 Louise. I've lost that. I've lost completely that one. Semolina. Oh, listen, even when I hear the word semolina, I feel a little bit nauseous. Anyway, let's talk about simnel cake. Simnel cake is synonymous, isn't it, Mary-Anne, with Easter time?
It is. It is. And it's you know, simnel. While the cake itself has evolved since the kind of the 16th century, it has been a main part of Lent and Easter feasting and celebrations. But actually, not necessarily Easter Sunday itself. Mm. Actually, it goes back. So there's 6 Sundays in Lent. And then there is the 7th Sunday, which is Easter Sunday itself.
Yes.
So the middle Sunday in Lent, the 4th Sunday in Lent, was known as Mothering Sunday. Now, even though we still celebrate it as Mother's Day in kind of in the, you know, the British Isles and whatever, unlike the Americans where they do it in May, Mothering Sunday was not actually to do with, you know, your female parents. It was to do with celebrations of the Mother Church and specifically the Blessed Virgin. And it was a kind of a little bit of a respite from Lent. So in Ireland, we tend to take a break from Lent on St. Patrick's Day. But traditionally, the 4th Sunday in Lent was a big feast day. And the only day of the year, actually, that going back when you'd people working in big houses or working as servants or on the land, the only day they were guaranteed every year to have off was this particular day.
There you go.
And the 4th Sunday in Lent, and they, on condition, they would go home to their mother church. But it was, it had loads of other names as Mothering Sunday. It was known as Mid-Lent Sunday, Refreshment Sunday, because it was actually a big feast. You were allowed to break your Lenten feast. Rose Sunday, because the priests would wear a bright pink to lift from the drudgery of Lent. And this is one where the simnel and the, kind of comes in, but also historically known as Five Loaves Sunday. And Five Loaves Sunday was taken because it was a feast day to, I suppose, remember and celebrate the Feast of the Loaves and the Fishes. And so Simila is an ancient, it's a Latin word meaning a very fine, the highest quality of white flour you could get. And Simla buns would have been the bread that was made with the best quality ingredients you could possibly have. Fantastic. And so that flour reference is where semolina comes from as well, because semolina is...
Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. Now, tell me this. What is a simnel cake? What are the ingredients of a simnel cake if you were baking one?
Right. So a simnel cake is like a much lighter version of a Christmas cake with one big difference. So, well, two big differences. Firstly, there isn't alcohol in it, because even during Lent, it was a feast, there was never an alcohol put into it. And then also the addition of marzipan, which really has only come in the last probably 150 years. But now how it differs is when you make it, you'd make your cake batter, and I can give you a quick recipe in a minute for it. It's not a very complicated one. Half your batter would go into the cake tin, a disc of marzipan, and then the rest of the cake batter on top, and that's baked together. So you have a layer of marzipan in the middle, and then when it comes out and it cools, you have marzipan on top, and then 11 balls of marzipan representing the 11 kind of disciples, Judas's persona non grata. So he's left out. But my sister-in-law, her late mother, would always put 12 on, because she always believed Jesus would have, you know, would have forgiven Judas. So he deserved a place. So there you go. Fair enough.
So 11 little marzipan 11 balls on the top
to
of it.
To represent eggs.
Yes.
So balls, eggs, because eggs obviously representing Easter, because you weren't allowed of eggs during Lent.
Yes.
And they were a big celebration because you were allowed to eat them on Easter Sunday. So to make the cake, I mean, it's a very, very simple cake. It's not as heavy at all as a Christmas cake, but it would be, you know, 8 ounces for, say, a classic 8-inch tin, or kind of a deep tin. 8 ounces of butter and 8 ounces of either, like a light brown sugar creamed together. And then, you cream those and you'd add 4 eggs in on top of it. And then 8 ounces of self-raising flour, and that's your basic cake.
Okay.
And then into that, then you'd put probably about another pound of mixed fruit. So maybe 4 ounces of cherries, 8 ounces of sultanas or raisins, some candied peel, that kind of thing. And you know, everyone's taste. Some people love currants. I can't stand them in a fruit cake. I think it's like finding a little bit of tar in a cake. But some people like to put that in. So about a pound's worth of mixed fruit, including your glacé cherries and your candied peel, and then the zest of an orange and a lemon, and 2 tablespoons of mixed spice. And just mix all of that together into an 8-inch tin, half of the mixture into an 8-inch tin. And then on top of that, you'd need a pound of marzipan. Sounds like a lot, but if you get a pound, or, you know, your 450 grams in a round of marzipan, and divide that into three, one-third of it, then you roll into a disc slightly smaller than the cake tin. When you put half your cake batter in, you put your disc of marzipan in, put the rest of the cake batter in and bake that at a low oven. So, you know, maybe about 150 degrees, which is quite low because standardly a sponge cake would be about 180, maybe 140 if you have a fan oven that's particularly hot. And it would probably take about 2 hours, 20 minutes, maybe 2.5 hours, depending on your oven, until it kind of, it rises and it's evenly brown and firm to the touch. You can test with a skewer, but testing with a skewer, you just have to be mindful that the marzipan in the centre
yes.
will be a bit sticky when it's hot. So just, and then when it's cooled, you take it out. When it's cooled, and again, unlike a Christmas cake, you don't douse it brandy or whiskey or anything like that. When it's cooled, just brush a little bit of, say, melted or heated marmalade or apricot jam or something to make it sticky. You still have 2/3 of your marzipan left. 1/3 of it, you roll to a disc again and cover the top of the cake, and the final third, divide into 11 or 12 if you're feeling the forgiveness and the love for Jesus, and put those on. And then you just attach those balls on, wet them, and they'll stick and under the grill and give it a quick toasting.
Lovely. So, you've described it brilliantly.
Yeah. It's a lovely thing to do with children, because it's not a particularly difficult recipe. It's quite a classic, you know, for an 8-inch tin.
Four ounces
of butter, 4 ounces of self-raising flour, 4 ounces of sugar, 8 ounces of butter, sugar, flour, 4 eggs, a pound
easy.
Of fruit.
Yes.
It's not a hard one.
It's not easy. And you know what? You know what, Marianne? You have me, because I love marzipan, because I'm a big fan of Battenberg, to be honest with you. And when you mention cherries, you have my heart, young woman, because I just adore cherries. I absolutely do. It's my type of cake. But look, it's one. Is it made anymore? Do many people make it, would you believe?
I do.
Do you? Good on
I
you.
Do. Absolutely, yeah, and it lasts.
Yes.
And that was the other reason that it was kind of traditionally associated with Easter, because a lot of fruitcakes will last far longer than any other cake. They will stay, you know, and so when people would have this, and so the servants would come home, and they'd usually bring one home with them, and they'd have made it when they're at work, and they bring it home, and, you know, family were allowed to have it on that Sunday, but then it was put away, and it was kept, because you weren't allowed to eat it for the rest, and then it was brought out again on Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it sounds like, oh God, there's a lot of cake there, but it will last.
It will last. Well, I'll tell you one thing. If I had it on my table to see, well, I couldn't until it's Sunday because I'm off everything sweet for Lent. It wouldn't last for long. Have to leave it there today. Thank you for joining me on the show, Marianne.
You're very welcome.
God bless you. Take care. Bye-bye. No mistake. Simnel cakes. Get bacon for Easter. Who knows, Louise, after getting the eggs? What do you think? What are my chances? Is there a Simnel baker out there? I'll chance me arm. Late Lunch LMFM Radio. Back in a moment.
It's time for our Two on Tuesday.
Two on Tuesday.
Playing the songs that just never quite made it to number one.
But we were so close.
I'm supposed to be number one.
We were so close.
Two on Tuesday.
Yes, a little later than usual, and I'm breaking new ground today. I've never done this before because, you see, the Two on Tuesday comes from my artist of the week, Diana Ross. And I'm doing this today, especially for Diana, because she's 80 years young today. Happy birthday, Diana Ross. She's 80, and there's another big birthday today. Yes, Patsy Walsh is 88 today in Navan. Isn't she, Louise, your mammy? You better say a happy birthday there to her.
Happy big birthday, mammy. She said herself 2/8, so she's only 16.
I love her outlook. It's absolutely brilliant. Patsy, have a great day. They all love you. They love you. They really, really do. Two big birthdays happening today. Anyway, we'll dedicate this song to Patsy as well, because, you see, it was number 2 for 2 weeks late in 1991 on the 14th of December. And it took a break for a week and then back at number 2 on the 28th of December, but never made it to number 1. Yes, it's Miss Diana Ross. And when you tell me that you love me, here we go.
Only for you, all the impulses.
and feel the pain. I know what's beautiful looking at you. In a world of lies, you are the truth. And baby, every time you touch me, I become a hero. I'll make you safe no matter where you are, and bring you everything you ask for. Nothing is above me. I'm shining like a candle in the dark when you tell me that you love me.
Diana Ross, our two on Tuesday. Brilliant song, When You Tell Me That You Love Me. So what prevented Diana making number one with that fantastic song? Well, it was Mr. George Michael and Elton John combined. Here are the lads. That's the song that prevented our Diana Ross making it to number one with When You Tell Me That You Love Me. Louise, the jury sits. The court is in session. Which one for you?
I reckon I'll go with The Birthday Girl.
Will you?
Yeah, definitely.
Ah, so will I today. I love the other song. The other song's a brilliant song too. But I'm going with The Birthday Girl. You're right today. With Patsy. We're going with Patsy today for sure on our big birthday day. Yes, that's unanimous. The court has decided. We've gone for the two on Tuesday from Diana Ross. Ah, yes, two great songs. Anyway, Louise, will you go make that little telephone call there and we'll see what happens. While I mentioned the Railway Preservation Society of Ireland, the phone is ringing. Let's see what happens. Let's see, will we get an answer? Because I have a €100 voucher to give away to the Valley Inn, as you know.
Hello?
Hello, Rory.
Yes.
Is that Rory O'Neill?
It is indeed.
Gerry Kelly, LMFM Radio's Late Lunch. How are you?
How you doing? How you keeping, Gerry?
I'm keeping very well. Where are you today? Where do you live, please?
Riverbank here in Drogheda.
Sure, I could have went over and rang your doorbell.
Exactly.
I didn't know where you were. There you are, you're next. I think of the closest call we've ever made to the station. Yes. Anyway, Rory. Yes. The Valley Inn. How would a €100 sound voucher for the Valley Inn? Would you like that?
Oh, yeah. It'd be nice, all right, Jim.
Yeah. What do you do with yourself? Tell us a bit about you. What are you up to at the minute?
Just at home with the child, the daughter at the minute.
Oh, lovely. So she's keeping you entertained, is she?
Oh, she is indeed, yeah.
Good stuff. Well, listen, are you ready for this most difficult question? So what I've done, Rory, is I've checked out the Valley Inn a la carte menu, and today I've had a look at the main courses there. And what I'm going to do now is put to you three main courses that you'd find on probably any menu. But there's one of these main courses on the Valley Inn menu, okay? There's just one of them. So I need one answer, and I'll take your first answer. If you get it, you win it. If not, we move on. So on the Valley Inn a la carte menu, do they offer A, sweet and sour chicken, B, beef rendang, or C, golden fried scampi?
I think it's a B.
No, it's not, Rory. I'm sorry. I can't say which. I'm sorry. Listen, thanks for taking our call. God bless you. Take care of yourself. Bye, Rory. Bye. We're going to have to call somebody else. Oh, my God almighty. I'm sorry for Rory. I just wanted to give it away. And anyway, he made the wrong choice. Let's see who's up next on the line to see if they get it right. And late lunch this time. I'm not even sure who this is. Well, we'll find out when the phone is answered anyway. We'll see who it is. If we get an answer, please call
Hello.
Hello. Who's that, please?
This This is Sandra Matthews here. How are you?
Sandra Matthews, this is Gerry Kelly on the Late Lunch Show on LMFM Radio.
Oh, hello, Gerry. How are you?
I'm really good. Where do I find you today? Where are you living, please?
Well, I'm living in Dunlear.
Lovely. Great stuff. And a fine place.
I'm working down in Lordship today. That's where I'm working at the
moment. Oh, lovely part of the world as well, Lordship. There you go. Anyway, you entered a competition for the Valley Inn. Yes, you did.
I did indeed.
Have you ever been to the Valley Inn?
I have. I go there on quite a regular basis.
Oh, you're another regular.
I go to John and Jackie quite often.
Ah, well, you'd certainly use the €100 voucher, wouldn't you?
I will indeed, yes.
Oh, well, now, fingers crossed, we've made a call already and unfortunately Rory didn't get it right. So what I've done is I've gone to the Valley Inn a la carte menu, right? And I've picked out one item from the menu and I've mixed it in with a couple of other main course items from other menus. But you have to get the one that the Valley Inn serves up. Okay, so there's one of these three served in the Valley Inn on their a la carte as a main course and you've got to pick it out. Are you ready?
Yes.
So listen carefully. I will say this only once. Is it, I want the one that's on the Valley Inn menu. Is it sweet and sour chicken? That's A. B, beef rendang, or C, golden fried scampi?
Golden fried scampi.
You know your Valley Inn. You certainly do. You are right. It is the golden fried scampi. The other two aren't on the menu, even though they're gorgeous, I know. Sweet and sour chicken and beef rendang. It is golden fried scampi. So there you are. You have a €100 voucher.
That's
for
fantastic.
The Valley Inn. Ah, listen, Sandra. And what do you do? Do you work or what has you in the Lordship today?
I work in a community house.
Lovely. Good on you. Very worthwhile work, may I say.
That's it.
Well, there you are. If you were going to the Valley Inn, give our listeners a tip, because we have more goodies to give away from the Valley Inn, and we're coming live from the Valley Inn on Late Lunch on Thursday afternoon with Late Lunch. If you were going to the Valley Inn, now you've won a lovely €100 voucher,
yes.
And I'm sure you've tasted the scampi if you're a fish person in the past. What's your favourite on the Valley Inn menu?
Oh, my favourite is the garlic mushrooms and the sizzling chicken.
Oh, there you go. Ah, oh, I'm certainly salivating when I hear both of those because I love them myself. Anyway, Sandra Matthews, thank you for taking the call. Health aware. Enjoy the €100 in the Valley Inn.
Thanks a million, Gerry. That's great. Thanks.
Take care
of
yourself. Bye. Take care. That's Sandra Matthews from Dunlear in Lordship this afternoon. We have another €100 tomorrow to give away in the show, so don't despair. It could be you. After three on Late Lunch, funny things in food and my artist of the week. Now, we'll roll this at this time again on Late Lunch.
The Late Lunch Artist of the Week.
Artist of the Week.
Yes, it's the birthday girl. Diana Ross is 80 years young today and looking great, I have to say. Let's take her story into the 70s this afternoon. And Diana Starr was in the ascendancy. Most everything she touched turned to gold. Chart hits with albums and singles flowed. She toured the world to packed out audiences. Did you know this? She was the first entertainer to have a private audience with the wife of Japan's famous emperor, Hirohito. She became the first African-American woman to co-host the Academy Awards. She appeared in the movies Lady Sings the Blues and Mahogany, which were both quite successful. However, her short move to the big screen ended with the release of The Wiz. It was sort of a play on The Wizard of Oz. Her third big screen appearance, and it would be her last, because see, the movie was a flop. Yeah, some things don't go right all the time, even for Diana Ross. Sticking with music, her album The Boss topped the charts in 1979, before a year later, in 1980, she released her final album on the Motown label, and probably her best ever, simply titled Diana, from which I take my song today. Yes, on her 80th birthday, it's the big, big hit, I'm Coming Out.
We'll be right back.
Ross, my artist of the week, and I'm coming out on Late Lunch this Tuesday afternoon. Earlier on the show, I was speaking to Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer about her brilliant new book called The Cancer Guide, and I'm sending that one out there today to Bernie O'Sullivan. That's yours, Bernie. Be in the post shortly to you, and thanks to everybody who's been in touch. Final break of the afternoon. A dead mouse in a punnet of strawberries. Glass and a loaf of bread. Oh my God, yes. Food Safety of Ireland. We're talking to them next. Imagine finding a snail in your coleslaw. Well, there'll be a bit of nutrition in that, all right. A dead mouse in your strawberries, a metal pin in your salad, or glass in bread. Not nice for sure. The Food Safety Authority of Ireland issued a report yesterday, and they were among some of the findings in foodstuffs that just shouldn't be. I'm joined by Jane Ryder, Communications Manager with FSAI. Jane, thanks for joining me on the show.
No problem, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Now, a bit dramatic, aren't I, being there, picking those little bits and pieces out from your report? The exception rather than the rule, those things, yes?
Well, the complaints that we get to the advice line, yeah, they would be the exception. But at the same time, last year we had 4,395 complaints from consumers, and 31.9% of those related to hygiene standards. That would be the top type of complaint. And the one that you were mentioning there was the unfit foods, which would be the next highest. So the hygiene standards, the kind of complaints that we get is things like dirty toilets, staff handling food and cash with the same gloves, bins overflowing and attracting rodents, visibly dirty premises, rodents spotted in businesses. So they are, we find every year with the complaints, they happen all the time. So it's not that they were on an increase, but these things do unfortunately happen in food businesses.
4,395 to the special line there dedicated. Your inspectors are on the ground as well. You do rely on the public's help, and I think you want to emphasise that today. If members of the public find anything, see anything, or are concerned about anything, you should pick up the phone and call.
Yeah, or it's, we have an online complaint form, so it's better to fill in that on our website. Yeah, we, as you said, the consumers, they're out in all the food businesses every day. The inspectors aren't and can't be everywhere.
Mm.
Whereas when we're out, you know, in a restaurant or in a cafe or in a pub, if we see something, instead of just, you know, going home and telling our friends, we should actually be making a complaint. Because this means that the inspector can go and inspect the premises and then make sure that whatever was wrong has been corrected. And that's really, really important. So, yeah, we want people, and we thank people for doing it, because as consumers, we all have a right to safe food. So a food business has to be serving us safe food. So if you do see something and it's not right, or it's dirty, or you're served something and it's what we classify as unfit, so in other words, it's not safe to eat, you just go to our website. We have an online complaint form, and that is found at fsai.ie/make it better.
Very simple to get that there. And what's the, do you have the number of that line if people want to call it?
We do. We prefer you to fill in the form, to be honest.
Okay,
Mary,
okay.
We can give you all the information. So the form is better, because the more
fair
information
enough
we have, yeah, it's better for us.
Okay.
The inspectors then.
Let's push that then. fsai.ie/make it better. The form is there, and that is the best way to lodge your concerns. Regarding your inspectors and that, I take it they do random calls and random checks unannounced.
Yeah, all their visits are unannounced.
Yes.
So a business will never know when their inspector is going to call. And so that would happen, that happens on an annual basis. But then this is an extra visit. So if you make a complaint to our advice line, an inspector will go out and make another visit based on that complaint. So that's also important, because obviously, like, there's 54,000 food businesses, inspectors can't be in there every day.
Mm.
So, that would be an extra visit. But as I said, all visits from inspectors are unannounced, so they never know when they're coming.
Yes, and of course, what you issue in the report is a portion of what perhaps is wrong out there, because you said they can't be everywhere. Other people just go home and bitch about things and don't actually report them. So the level is probably higher. What do you reckon overall in an Irish context? How are we doing? How is our food that we consumed? Is it at a good standard, would you say? A very good standard?
It would be a very good standard.
Okay.
I mean, these numbers aren't overly high.
Yes.
Plus, also, you're probably aware of our when we do enforcement orders, that might be when we close down a business. Those numbers will be quite small on the scale of how many businesses they are. So yeah, the standard in Ireland would be very high. But obviously we want it to be high everywhere in every business.
Absolutely.
So that's what we're always trying to achieve, because food law is very simple and it simply says the food has to be safe to eat. Mm. And that's the legal requirement rests on the food business owner. So it's the food business that must ensure that the food yes. that we're buying and eating is safe to eat.
Yes.
And it's not difficult. Like, it's quite that, you know, food law is quite, it's basic. It's keep, you know, have a clean premises. It's kind of what you would do in your own home kitchen, but to a higher standard. But it's not difficult to do. To have a place clean, to make sure that, you know, food is stored correctly at the correct temperatures, to make sure that your staff know what they're doing, to make sure that, you know, you've pest control, because we would see that a lot with the closure orders, is where there's pest control issues and rodents are able to get in. And that's not something that anybody wants.
Absolutely not. Have to leave it there today. FSAI.ie/makeitbetter. Report it. That's the message today. Thank you so much for joining me, Jane, on the show.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. Bye. That's it on Late Lunch this afternoon. Eddie Caffrey's on his way with The Drive. We're back midweek Wednesday from 1:30. We'll see you then and leave you in the company of the brilliant Noah Cahan and Stick Season. See you tomorrow.
As you promised me that I was more than all the miles combined, you must have had yourself a change of heart like halfway through the drive, because your voice trailed off exactly as you passed my exit sign.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.